Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
Turkey's better, and Falling Stars. It was Divergent. I was not a fan of him as Caleb.
Whoa, what are you talking about Divergent for? Have I officially started this podcast yet?
I did just see a preview for The Giver, which I hadn't seen yet.
I haven't seen a preview for The Giver either.
It was before Divergent.
Yeah.
The trailer for the trailer for The Giver was one of the 10 previews we saw before Divergent.
Oh, see, I haven't seen it. It's because I don't see many movies.
but you saw Divergent. So
I did,
that's when we saw it. We saw it before Divergent. I mean, given the theater could obviously choose to show different things.
Because I don't think I've seen it.
Mm. And I was like, what is this, a Maze Runner? And then it wasn't. And then we saw a Maze Runner preview two previews later.
I haven't seen that one either. I didn't even know that was going to be a movie until I was looking at a list of movies made into books to see this year.
Is that something you've read?
I have, but I've only read the first one because I wasn't a huge fan. No.
Well, that's the thing, though. I really feel like you can probably only squeeze a couple more things out before there's going to be some fatigue. There's just not going to be enough room for, I think, all these young adult type books.
Especially the ones that are kind of futuristic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, people are going to get tired of those.
Yeah. Let me guess. Dystopian. This kid with his angst is the only person that can save the world. Heard it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that in and of itself is something we can talk to. But, anyway, the point is, I'm glad you're here. Because, like I said, I'm afraid that I'm not going to be able to have you on until, the fall. And our listeners deserve better than that. And you're sitting really far away.
Isn't Gone Girl coming out?
Have you started this podcast yet?
I have.
Yes. Gone Girl, is that in the fall?
It is.
Okay. Because that's a good one.
And it's, I think one comes out in September and one comes out at the beginning of October. So that would be back to back.
Okay.
So, anyway. I guess we should probably start. We're only about a half hour late.
Officially.
Because I couldn't remember. It's been so long since we podcasted.
I can't remember how to plug in the microphone.
Oh, no. There was two things I needed to do that I completely forgot to do. So, talk amongst yourselves.
It really hasn't been that long since we podcasted.
Well, we talked about this earlier today. Once you get used to doing something, you just kind of get in the habit. And now I'm out of the habit. So... I mean, I've been doing lots of work for the podcast. It's given me a lot of free time to work on the website and things like that. But I have had some other issues. Obviously, getting this done. Let's see.
Did you like Casual Vacancy?
I haven't read it. Somebody gave it to me. Any review I've heard of it, from friends, anything I've heard of it from friends doesn't really make me excited to pick it up. But
That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
So I haven't attempted it.
Yeah, it's kind of at the bottom. I do have The Giver, though, which I have never read, and I'm going to read it soon.
Yeah. Lois Lowry was actually on the same panel when I heard Veronica Roth.
Oh, cool.
Which was really neat, because I read her a long time ago. So.
Yeah, how old is she?
70s, I'm guessing. I might be guessing older, but 70s.
It just feels like she's been around for a really long time.
Yeah, she has.
She's like a name I remember for being a kid, I guess.
Yeah.
Making good stuff for a long time or just around for a long time?
I don't even know what else she's written. She's written more, but The Giver is I think there's 4 books, which I have not read. I've only read
The
first one, yeah.
I picked it up because especially when I was working at the high school, people would be like, you haven't read The Giver? What's wrong with you?
So, yeah, I didn't know for a long time that there was more than one, but I enjoyed it as a standalone.
Yeah.
I've read it a couple times. It's really good.
All right. I think I'm ready.
Okay.
We'll find out. I also didn't proofread my intro, so if I start stumbling over my words... I want you to laugh heartily as if we pretended to do that.
Okay. I'm trying to look up Lois Lowry, and a bunch of other people are coming up instead of her.
Okay. So, it's like pause.
She wrote Number of the Stars, which I really liked as a kid.
I knew there was something else that she wrote. Sorry. That's really good.
Which won a Newbery Medal?
I even put the pauses in there because I was getting ready to start.
You say, are you ready? Are you ready? You have to, like, do
I
didn't do that.
See how long it's been? So, Laura, are you ready?
Yes.
You can't have dead air on a podcast.
I like to do that, remember? Last time in Game of Thrones.
Okay, obviously you're not ready. Ari, are you ready?
I am ready.
You're so ready. Okay, well, if everyone's ready, then pause. Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 22. I am your host, Fizz. On this episode of the podcast, we dive again into the world of young adult literature adaptation by conversating about the hugely popular film Divergent. Hugely popular. Way more popular than any other movie that I would have talked about this week. In the adaptation, up-and-comer Shailene Woodley takes on our lead as Triss, who learns she's divergent and won't fit into a society that categorizes all of its citizens into factions. When she discovers a plot to destroy Divergence, Triss and the mysterious Four, played by the surprising Theo James, must find out what makes Divergence dangerous before it's too late. We will give our thoughts on the movie as an adaptation of the widely popular young adult or YA literature genre, and also explore the themes the book very intentionally raises about conformity, human nature, leadership, sacrifice, and identity, and things. I felt like when I was trying to think of the theme, I was like, oh my gosh, and this. So very, very worthwhile conversation. And I am pleased that I am joined this week by two Divergents themselves. First, my lovely wife, Laura Fissel.
Hello.
And her partner in literary crime, Arian Jones.
Hello.
It's good to have both you ladies on again. Like I said, I feel like you're like a tag team. I think I'm pretty sure I made the point that I didn't want to just have you on when I did books because I need other people who actually read books. And I seriously haven't found anyone else who read books. I've talked to so many people and people are just like, huh? I saw the movie. And I'm
you saying that all your friends are dumb?
I'm saying all my friends are dumb. Except for my female friends, who are apparently much smarter and can read.
Griffin reads comic books.
He does. And I would never discount that as a reading medium. But actually, no. Oh, I was going to say, he told me that he read this book. But then I realized he didn't read this book because I was discounting people who read audiobooks. Because you don't actually read an audiobook.
Did you read the audiobook?
I listened to a ton of audiobooks, and I totally count that as reading. If you read as well, but I did listen. I read Divergent, and then I listened to Divergent and enjoyed them both equally. Okay,
but you read it.
I did.
Okay, so.
Man, you're such an elitist.
I am, for someone who doesn't read, because I'm trying to keep myself out of that category. I don't want to give myself, like, it's all or nothing, so I'm either there or I'm not, and I have to put myself. I'm the snob here. Everyone else is really cool about this. And I'm not. So.
We've tried to find other people that read in other podcasts, and Griffin is like the only other person whose name comes up.
Yep.
So we're really struggling to find other people that read.
I think I've made a couple inroads with some people who podcast that actually read, and it's about spacing and time and availability and specific books having been read.
Yeah.
So, and like I said, ultimately, I feel like I have very few chances to have you on. So, I'm not going to let some upstart that I may have never even met, might completely enjoy their company digitally, take your place. So,
well,
anyway,
I appreciate it.
What a tangent. We already started on a tangent. Anyway, so after the tangent, we're going to start this like we do basically every other podcast. And with the super simple question, did you enjoy the movie? So, ladies?
I decided today that I'm going to say I did enjoy the movie because I liked more parts than I didn't like, and there were no parts that I hated. So, that's That's how I came to my conclusion. Also, I was pleasantly surprised by the main actors. I thought they did a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, and I think some of the things I really missed about that were not in the movie, that were in the book, similarly had to do with how I felt about the first Hunger Games. You know, not really... anyway, maybe that's a different topic, but I wanted more of Triss. I wanted to know her better. I wanted to be able to relate to her more. But overall, I think I liked it.
You enjoyed it.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to say yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Okay.
I really enjoyed the movie. Once again, I believe I enjoyed the book more than the movie, but I also think the book helped me to enjoy the movie
mm-hmm.
even more. It probably filled in some blanks that I didn't even realize were being filled in because I had that background knowledge. There was one part that I thought was corny, and we can go into that later, but other than that, I really enjoyed it and thought it was great, and I'd actually love to see it again.
Huh. Well... I feel like, much like the first Hunger Games movie, we'll get into this as well, because it's almost, you have to mention all the other young adult kind of adaptations and movies out there right now when you mention something like this, because some people think, oh, is this getting made because it's a good story,
mm-hmm.
Or is this getting made because it's the newest, hottest thing? And I think there's probably a little bit of both going on there. If I'm going to compare... I would say that I really enjoyed this movie a lot more than I did the first Hunger Games movie. And as we kind of tangented at the beginning of the podcast, I didn't read either book. So I didn't have like a background or necessarily a bias going in. And I felt like I understood more of the world in this one than like in the Hunger Games movie. I at least moderately cared about what was going on, unlike... like a Twilight series where I felt like, I don't want to get into that right now, I guess. I felt like there was substance to the story, mm-hmm. more that would appeal to a crowd more so than just love triangle.
Yeah.
When
you finished watching the Hunger Games, like the first movie, you, like, we had a big conversation about how you felt like you were really confused a lot of the time. And then, like, me and some other people who had read the book said it made a lot more sense to us because we had that context. Did you feel the same way after you came out of Divergent, that you were missing something because you didn't have that context?
No, I feel like, well, at least as far as I feel I can know.
Mm-hmm.
Divergent did a good job of telling me what was going on and to a certain degree why it was going on. The parts of Divergent that I had two big problems with Divergent. The movie, obviously. One is that it took me about half the movie to really get into the movie because to me the initial premise is so silly that I was rolling my eyes. I was like, and I leaned over to Laura and I was like, so wait, so it's like they have a city-wide sorting hat and it just puts you in different like things. And I mean, it just, anyway, we can talk about it a little bit later, but I understand that society does this already, but when you make it that technicolor, that this is what's happening, I feel like your premise is hard for me to get on board with. Now, given the conflict between all that, I thought picked up and kept me interested, even though, like I said, I'm not really on board with the premise. Outside of that, my only real fault was the stakes always... I was always told the stakes were a lot higher than the stakes really felt. Like, everyone was like, don't you understand? Things are crazy. And I'm like, are they really? Because she's just kind of hanging out. I mean, I think if things are crazy, people would be like crazy. And I don't necessarily. I think that was just. I think that was a cinematic fault, not necessarily the story. Because I believe didn't you? I think Laura told me that like in the book, it actually seems like the stakes are higher, or they do a better job of kind of letting you know why things are.
yeah, series is there? I think one of the ways that this is very different from The Hunger Games is that it's not... the world, the issues going on in the world are kind of an undertone. They're not as pressing as they are in The Hunger Games. I mean, it's not really about life and death. I mean, it's about her... I mean, there's a big choice she has to make about identity, about how she's going to live her life. But even in the book, they have, like, family visiting day, you know? So she still sees her family after she's chosen... I mean, and we are doing spoilers, right? I mean, like, we're talking in general about the movie.
Okay, yeah. And in general, so we will say that to talk about the themes of any movie fully, we're going to have to get into what happens throughout the entire movie. And because of that, we are going to spoil this. So if you have not seen the movie yet or read the book, then I would encourage you to go. We've already got to the point where we said that we all enjoyed it to some degree. So I would encourage you to go see it. I think it's worth your time. But you might want to stop listening to this until as soon as you get done, then directly put this in your iPod, in your car, on the way home, and enjoy the conversation. So, with that said.
Okay, so she, even though it is a big decision for her to choose Dauntless, which is not her family faction or whatever, it's really like a coming-of-age story in the beginning. And honestly, like, most of the book is about what ended up being a montage, really, in the movie, which is about her training to be Dauntless, trying to figure out, I mean, she's made this choice to be in this faction, so now she has to come to terms with, is that really her? Is she able to do that? Or is she going to wash out? And there are a lot of, like, pretty intricate relationships that she has with other initiates, and, like, building trust with them, and then them all being pitted against each other in the standings, and... So anyway, it really is not, I mean, I don't think it should feel like the stakes of the larger world are really pressing, and because the kids aren't thinking about that.
Well, I'm not necessarily talking about the stakes of the entire world. I mean, at one point, yes, I am referring to those stakes. But I mean, even the stakes of her washing out of Dauntless, I was like, is she really worried about this?
Yeah.
It just kind of seems like, it still seems like a game.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that, and I even said to you that it would, if they had highlighted really the factionless and how they live and why they're feared,
the
and
consequences,
why you, right, and why you don't want to be factionless, then the stakes would have been a little bit higher. But anyway, so I agree with that. But in general, it's much more lighthearted than The Hunger Games.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's more of a... it's definitely something that's fleshed out more in the subsequent books as far as what's wrong with the society. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's almost a little deceiving because you're like, oh, things seem kind of pretty good in this system. You know, it's not perfect, but it doesn't really seem like a horrible, like, government and system until maybe towards the end.
Unlike The Hunger Games, which basically throws you into a
system,
and you're like, stuff is messed up.
Yeah,
right.
And obviously something needs to change. This one we're like, this seems to be working.
Yeah.
I mean, parents are a little sad when they don't see their kids, and maybe we have some problems with that.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
I think I noticed in the book, the point where I was like, oh, something's wrong here, is when... Four shows Triss his tattoo that has all of the different factions on it. And I was like, oh, that kind of makes sense that you should, you know, be a combination instead of just having one quality that you focus on. So that was kind of the point in the book for me that I was like, oh, this isn't maybe as great as they're painting it to be.
Well, and we're kind of hitting on this, but I would love, like, kind of... specific, I guess, reaction. Well, since we can't get through talking about this without specifically comparing it to other young adult type books or young adult enticing type, well, not necessarily the books, but just the movies, like, do you feel that this one is starting off on a better foot than maybe some of the other series? I mean, because even if you want to throw in something like Harry Potter into that conversation, I don't feel like the first Harry Potter movie was that good really at all. I think it became beloved because people enjoyed the series as it went on.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing with The Hunger Games. I was ready to kind of not... I was like, I guess I'll go see the second Hunger Games movie because the first one made $1 trillion, not really $1 trillion, but, you know, tons of money. Yeah. People are obviously into it. Maybe it'll get better. And it was so much better. I mean, we talked about it on the show when we reviewed it. The second Hunger Games was so much better. I was like, this is a great movie, but still, it started out kind of bad.
Yeah.
I mean, do you feel like this one's got the best start? Do you feel like it's kind of on par? Do you think it's only going to get better? Like, where do you see this kind of finding its success comparatively?
I feel like when I started the Divergent series and I started reading it, you know, the first two books, after I read the first two books, my thoughts were, I think I like this better than The Hunger Games, comparing it to the books. Now, the movie adaptation of Divergent, I thought that it lacked, you know, some more, like, I think it could have used a little more character development, and I would have liked for it to have been more focused on relationships, but that's because I enjoy stories that are focused on relationships. What I think that it did really, really well, and it helped how it was received, was it really explained the society well, and it showed you what the factions were like. And so in the long run, I think that is a little more beneficial as far as drawing interest and getting people interested in the series.
Yeah. I think it's as strong, if not stronger, than the Hunger Games movie, the first one. And I'm pretty excited to see what they do next. I mean, initially when we saw the previews, we didn't really know the title actors very well or like anything they were in. And so we were pretty, at least Mikey and I, were pretty skeptical that, you know, like, and you said a lot, Mikey, that at least in the Hunger Games, they kind of hitched their star to the Jennifer Lawrence wagon. And after seeing her in Winter's Bone, everybody knew that she could, you know, she could carry that.
Mm-hmm.
But now after seeing Theo and what's her name?
Shailene.
Whatever it is. Triss. The girl who plays Triss. I feel like they're doing something really similar. I think they could probably do the same thing.
And it was, that was my theory, because I think that the Hunger Games could have failed miserably if they wouldn't have gotten some pretty notable actors to sign on to play some of the more key roles.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put, like, you pit Donald Sutherland as a bad guy, and you get Woody Harrelson to sign on as kind of like the mentor, you know, and then Jennifer Lawrence was already nominated for an Academy Award. You know, you get her to sign on to it as a strong, capable lead, where the worst she can do is the material that's given. You know, she will do the best with it as possible, you know, but she will never act below that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she won't ruin your movie. You know, you put her in a Star Wars movie, she'll do like Natalie Portman. She'll do the best she can with what she's got, but it won't be much. But so she had a little bit to work with in the Hunger Games and was very successful. And so I said the same thing about this one. I didn't really know who Shailene Woodley was. I definitely didn't know who Theo James was, but it was on my to-do list to watch The Spectacular Now, which got amazing reviews. Which Shailene Woodley was the star of. She was also in The Descendants, which I'm very upset that I still haven't seen yet. And apparently was fairly standout in that. So apparently she's already kind of earned her chops. She already looks like she's going to do a very good job in The Fault in Our Stars that comes out later this year. So I think they did hitch their wagon to the right star in this. I really enjoyed what she did, and I was really surprised by Theo James, because in the previews, he kind of looks like, Thor's brother from The Hunger Games, Liam Hemsworth.
Thor's brother, the reference to a different movie and not even the actor's name.
Yeah, that's right.
Not even the actor who you're...
Well, until he does something that's worthy to have his own, you know, to be noteworthy. Right now, he's not done anything that's... Liam Hemsworth.
Hemsworth. Oh, okay.
So I thought he was going to be like Liam Hemsworth. And Liam Hemsworth, to me, is like the love interest, but he really just, to me, the way he comes off in the movies is a warm body in The Hunger Games. And I was like, okay, so Theo James is just the good-looking dude that she falls in love with who has no personality. like Liam Hemsworth is in The Hunger Games.
Oh, come on. Liam is playing a character that's really two-dimensional. In the book, I mean, in the story, in general, he's not really given a lot of depth until maybe the third book.
Yeah.
So,
Liam is Gale, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just making sure. I agree. And
So, you haven't really seen what Gale is.
Can you name any other movies that Liam Hemsworth has been in that you were like, man, he really killed it?
I thought this was like his first one. Yeah. No. It's not.
I'm pretty sure he was the guy in Paranoia. I'll have to go look, and he was not very good in that either.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
So, with that said, Theo James, I was very surprised that I didn't think he was just a two-dimensional character. I don't know what he would do with, like, really deep material, but for what he was given in this first Divergent movie, I was like, that was surprising. You made me buy some stuff that I don't think I really would have bought from some other people. So all that to say, I feel like it's a better start than any other franchise in a comparable genre that I've seen recently. And I think that in of itself means that I'll go see Insurgent, right? Insurgent next book?
Yeah.
Yep, look how smart I am. So I'll go see the next one, but
sounds like Divergent.
Okay, so we've mentioned the factions over and over and over again. And just to clarify, I was going to have Arian, if you'll explain what the factions are.
Sure.
So it'll kind of frame the rest of our discussion so we have like a point of reference. Because we've already mentioned like Dauntless and stuff like that. Let us know, what are the faction names and what kind of people end up in those factions?
Okay, so there's Abnegation, which is the faction that Triss is, her family is a part of that one, and she was originally part of Abnegation. So they're kind of... quality is service. They're the public servants and also the ones who kind of run the government or the society. There's Erudite. They're the scholars and they're known for intelligence. There's Amity, and they are known for peacefulness, and they are the farmers. There's Candor. They're known for honesty, and they are the lawyers and the judges. There's Dauntless. They're known for fearlessness. And they are considered the protectors of the society.
Now, when we have these five factions...
Yes. Did I get all of them?
These five factions. I had my notes all squinched together, so I was like, wait, there's like six or seven lines there. Oh, there's our faction. Yeah, no, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so we have these five factions. Like, when you think about how they've divided them up or how the authors divided them up, do you think that there was something that was left out? Like, does that cover most everything?
I haven't thought about that before.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty good separation of main. I don't know. They seem pretty broad qualities to me.
I mean, like, who would construction worker fit under?
Probably Amity.
Yeah.
Builders. I mean, they build things.
Oh, do they?
The public servants. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're like the peacemakers who keep things together and keep people together and do the farming.
Oh, okay.
So I would say they probably would be the construction workers.
Yeah.
It would sound different because they'd probably call them carpenters, and it would be like, it wouldn't sound like they were not hippies.
They did look very hippie-ish.
They did look very hippie-ish.
Clothes,
their garb that they probably made out of hemp. okay, well then the follow-up question is, if that kind of covers everything, if you had to put yourself in one, like which one do you identify with the most?
I would say hands down that I would be an Amity because I'm not confrontational, so I don't think I could be Candor. I'm kind of a wuss about pain, and I don't get an adrenaline rush from falling or jumping, so I definitely wouldn't be Dauntless. I don't consider myself a scholar, necessarily. I don't really, really love learning, so I wouldn't be Erudite. And I just... I think I would feel suffocated by Abnegation.
Yeah.
So, I say Amity. I could be a hippie. I can wear long skirts.
Well, as someone from the proud house of Kandor, you're abnegation. Have a nice day.
I'm abnegation?
You're so abnegation.
Oh, wow.
Why?
Because all you do is serve people.
Yeah, but Amity does that too.
Yeah, but it's different. You're very selfless.
Don't put me in abnegation. Although she does have cool boots.
See? Not that you would ever look at them.
It's true.
Yeah.
Would ever look in the mirror. Why are you candor?
Because I have no problem speaking exactly how things are. I'm a big fan of frankness. I would say I would be a good judge. If only I would have gone into law instead of making podcasts for free.
Well, I think you'd be erudite, so bam.
Well. Man, there's so much conflict here.
We're all divergent.
Maybe we're all... What setup?
What about you, Arian?
Oh, gosh. It's so hard.
She reads books. She's an erudite.
Not dauntless, because I'm not fearless. Become more and more honest with age, but I really don't think I would fit in that category. Peacefulness, no.
No.
And the reason I say no to that is because, you know, I'm totally not into farming. So I'm just like, that throws that out the window.
I don't build, I don't farm.
I enjoy purchasing from farmers, but doing it myself, no thanks. And I really don't think abnegation. I don't really feel like I fit in erudite because I don't feel like I'm a super smart, intelligent person, but I do love learning. I could make a career out of going to school.
Being a scholar.
Yeah.
Like, reading books, working in a library.
Yes. Hypothetically. So that's why I think I would fit somewhat into erudite, but I don't see myself as some of the people that were represented in the movie.
Yeah. Well, I think, and that's maybe another fault of the movie, because I think there's probably a lot of really good people in erudite.
Mm-hmm.
Erudite.
Erudite.
If I was an erudite, I know how to say it. Obviously, it can't be in it. So,
yeah, they are very stereotyped.
Yeah.
Because I think there are people in Dauntless who probably... Anyway, they're all, like, seen as people who love to just do, like, crazy, wild things.
Yeah.
I'm the protector, but we all died because we jumped off a train.
Exactly.
You now have no protectors left in your city.
Exactly.
You know, it's like... There's a difference between being brave and being stupid, you know, like there's adrenaline junkies and there's people who like I got two very different messages of what Dauntless is from this movie. One was like, we are adrenaline junkies.
Yeah.
And one was like, it's brave to, you know, sacrifice your life for someone else. And I'm like, wait a minute. Like, those are not the same thing.
Yeah.
And so it was like, hey, I had this idea that I would think a good idea of a character trait that people have, but then you almost make it like a cartoonish representation of what that would probably realistically mean. I guess if you have a story and you kind of have to quickly tell it, you can't tell, like, someone's whole life and how they're consistently brave over, like, 20 years. So you were like, hey, they do these crazy things. So obviously you wouldn't do that, so you wouldn't fit in there. So,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, yes, I agree that the people in the factions tend to be very stereotyped. But, I thought I wrote this quote down, but I just saw in Divergent today as I was kind of skimming over it that Triss even says that she kind of feels a little bit like bipolar about what Dauntless means, because on the one hand, she sees people doing all these crazy, wild things. And then on the other, she cites two different examples of when she's seen that community, like, come together and care for each other. One of them being when she jumps off the wall when she is first initiated. It's not that. It's when she rides the zip line. She's actually caught at the bottom by a net of hands. Everyone's there to catch her at the end of the zip line, which they didn't do in the movie. But there were things like that when she felt like... She felt like people were bravely looking out for one another, or that was a different kind of courage. So, yes, I agree the movie didn't do that so well. But Dauntless, I think, is supposed to be kind of like, it's supposed to be multi-dimensional.
Okay. Well, what this had me, what was tearing me up was I wanted to immediately reject this notion that, like, we can be factioned, like, as human beings.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, I think of concepts or verses in the Bible that are like, you know, we're all one body and we have many different parts. You know, basically, this city is a body and it has different parts. And it's nice to really, I mean, it really honestly is nice to know kind of how you fit, because, you know, the hand is not an eye, the eye is not an ear, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, pretending you're something you're not isn't really helpful, and it's lying to yourself. So I'm like, oh, I'm conflicted. Do I not agree with the premise of this movie, or do I think that this is what we're doing already? I mean, where would you fall on that seesaw? Like, do you think that we want to be factioned? Or do you think it's better to... Or do you think...
do we all want to be divergence?
Do we all want to be divergence?
Yeah. I feel... there was an interview with Veronica Roth. It may have been the one that you sent to us, where she talks about, you know, how she wrote this book when she was graduating high school and moving... Or no, maybe graduating college.
Yeah, graduating college.
And trying to decide if she was going to go to grad school and, like, what she was going to do with her life. And she just had no idea what she really wanted to do. And I think that's a very real, you know, feeling when you're going into college or leaving college, like, what are you going to do? And you feel like you have to find the perfect thing and find the perfect fit. And then we take, like, these career and personality tests that tell us where, you know, where we fit. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it's very clear and that's okay. But I think sometimes, just like with Tris, it's not very clear. And so that can be really confusing when you don't have a good fit.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes we try to make a choice based on the rest of our lives, you know, that's how I felt coming out of college, was that whatever I choose is what I'm going to be doing forever and ever.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having this concept that I'm a person who's going to grow and change based on my experiences, my age, and that might change. You know, what I want to do with my life might change, and that's okay. So, yeah.
Well, something that really struck me, because one of the things I really liked about the movie was that it made me stop and think about how society works now. And it gave me, like, an epiphany, if nothing else, or it just made me really stop and think, especially in prepping for the show, does society want to be factioned? And I kind of said, you know what? I don't necessarily know if... I think we would reject the idea of being factioned, but we all struggle with our identity. We want to know how we fit in and who we fit in with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and this is why, like, oh gosh, they're so popular right now, but, like, I can't go on Facebook without finding out, like, what Divergent faction someone is, what Lord of the Rings character they are, what Twilight character they are, what Doctor Who doctor they are, and what breakfast food they are. You know, I'll see someone, they'll post and be like,
oh, BuzzFeed.
They're like, I'm toast. I knew it. You know,
like, how I'm does like, that work?
Okay, I guess you're excited that you're toast. You know, people who get really excited because they, you know, they suddenly have an identity. Mm-hmm. And
yet they keep taking BuzzFeed quizzes, so they clearly don't have a good handle on their identity.
Yeah. I mean, like, they're like, yes, I knew it. But if you really knew it, then why are you taking a quiz? You know, are you doing it just because you want to know what character you relate to? But honestly, you probably should know. You know, like, if you have these particular qualities, you know, you probably have more in common with, you know, Gandalf and not Thoromir. You know, or, you know, just whatever. You're not Frodo because, you know, these aren't your character traits. And I think where I ended up landing with Divergent is that, as long as people continue to identify themselves, not just realize that they have different traits, but as long as they identify themselves by things that are not, or that it's not their identity in Christ, then they're always going to have this temporary satisfaction.
Hmm.
They're always going to be like, yeah, I'm a Gandalf-like person, but that you already talked about, people grow and they change. So your identity is very temporary, yeah. as opposed to like our identity in Christ, which makes us who we are, gives us mission, gives us purpose.
Hmm.
They want being like Gandalf to give them purpose, but it doesn't. It
needs to be something broader than your job or...
It doesn't make you part of a body.
Yeah.
And that's what's really made me sad. I don't know, Arian, how much you've paid attention. It's kind of hard not to, much like the BuzzFeed quizzes. Right now, there's a big to-do about the Noah movie coming out this week.
I saw something about that on Facebook today, and I was like, I'm going to skip over that.
Yeah, like, there's also, you know, there's people who are either going to go see it or not going to go see it or should totally stay away from it. And a lot of that has to do with... what makes a Christian film, what makes not a Christian film. Because there's a couple other movies that have come out recently, Son of God, God's Not Dead, that are explicitly Christian films. And Noah is not made by people who are Christians, for the most part. Yeah. I'm sure there are some Christians that are involved in making it. But since it's not a Christian film, it doesn't fit that mold. There's like a pressure to conform to some Christian faction that's not actually Christ related in any way.
Yeah.
And it's just like more proof that there's something wrong with how we're factioning ourselves. Mm-hmm. So like I said, all that to say, I feel like I'm coming to terms with the fact that society doesn't want to be factioned, but at the same time, they're trying to use something that's not a faction, which is our identity, as a faction. Like, just making all that up.
Oh, man. Maybe that was statement was so deep I need to, like, unpack it with a diagram. That's all just very interesting, that perspective. I hadn't really thought about that. And just thinking about the BuzzFeed quizzes, and like you said, if you... shouldn't you already know which person you are? And I was kind of thinking, that's true. Like, I kind of feel that way. Like, I can, you know, already assume which character I am from Pride and Prejudice or something that I know really well, you know.
But what would it change?
But at the same time, there is kind of this insecurity that, like, am I seeing myself right? You know, like... Or am I wanting to be Elizabeth Bennet because I want to have those qualities, but I don't really? And so, like, almost an insecurity and wanting someone to verify or... there's another word I'm looking for. It starts with an A. But say to you...
Affirm?
Yeah, affirm. Affirm that, like, you are what you think you are. You have the qualities you think you have. But, I agree that, like, we want to belong to something, but we... typically are finding belonging to things that are very temporary, that are going to change. Or, you know, maybe you belong to a group because of maybe you belong to a certain part of society because you can hear, but then you have an accident and you lose your hearing and now you're a part of a whole new, like, you know, way of communicating or different society of people. So that's just interesting to think about what we're building our identity on.
Well, it's like I said, it's like taking a character trait and making it who you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, Arian's a generally happy person. You're happy. That's what you are. You know, but that's not really who you are. Yeah. Like, you're so much more than that. And I feel like that's kind of one of my qualms with how the factions work in Divergent, because it tells them, because they're a certain way, like, that's also their purpose, but they don't really have a purpose for being the way they are, I guess, unless you consider, like, everyone's working for the greater good.
Yeah.
But they're not really. So what's the onus of having, you know, like I said, you're taking a character trait, like bravery,
mm-hmm.
or a desire to learn or honesty, and you're turning it to someone's purpose. And I feel like that's not necessarily... That's a leap that I think you could erroneously make, but I don't think it's who you are, which is why, you know, like, if we tried to fit, like, Jesus into a faction, like, he wouldn't fit. Because I would say that his purpose, and if we're to emulate him, would say, He would say, do all these things.
Yeah.
Be brave, be smart, you know, be divergent, but not just so you're different or because it's cool to be a mix of things. It's because one directly affects the other.
Mm-hmm.
Like by having one trait, it gives purpose to some of the other traits.
You all may have thought about this as you're watching the movie or reading the book, but I couldn't help but think of abnegation as the Christian.
Yeah.
And not necessarily, and when I say that, I mean like the stereotypical Christian faction. And I get that kind of because, you know, I went to Liberty University for school, for undergrad, and it just kind of felt like the same things.
Did you all wear gray?
You know, you're encouraged to be very modest, which is fine. You're encouraged to wear, you know, you have to wear certain clothes to class when I was there. You have a curfew and, you know, looks are not really something that is, you know, it, like in abnegation, they're encouraged not to look at themselves in the mirror. And, and so it just, and their whole idea is service, mm-hmm. which is great. But if you are just doing service for the sake of service, then, you know, there's some things missing there. Mm-hmm. If that's the only way you're thinking about Christianity.
Well, I just, it's hard to me to imagine that someone, and maybe it's because I'm so non-abnegation that I just don't understand it.
Yeah.
But like, I don't understand why someone would choose to do that. Like, they would never choose to, I don't know, like want to do other things, or why they would always want to be like, hey, you're good at making dinner, so make dinner all the time for everyone. You know, it's like, well, I just because I enjoy doing something doesn't mean I yeah. want to do it for everybody all the time. And so, like you said, it seems like that over-characterization of something.
It's interesting that, like, on the surface, things seem very compartmentalized. But then if you really, I don't know, through the course of the story, I think some of those stereotypes break down a little bit.
Yeah.
Because here you've got, like, the abnegation being the, like, the selfless, never, you never think of yourself, always think of others. And then you have this example of a really horrible father who scarred his son for life. And, you know, his son has run away from him because of abuse. And he's like the leader of abnegation. So if you're, that's kind of a, just kind of an interesting addition if you're kind of thinking of abnegation as a stereotypical religious group or whatever. But at the same time, something I found interesting when I was going back through the book today is that Triss's mom comes to see her and when she tells her mom her aptitude test results, she isn't surprised because apparently most divergents come from abnegation. And Janine actually says that again when they're, you know, they run into her and she has them captured and all that stuff. Janine is like frustrated because she doesn't understand why she says all these weak-minded people typically are the ones who can override they learn how to override the system with their minds. They become the divergents.
Hmm.
So they actually come often from abnegation. And so I was thinking about that. And I was thinking about how selflessness seems like it takes all those other qualities. Or it's not true selflessness. It takes courage to put yourself aside. It takes kindness. I mean, what is selflessness without kindness? It's not truly selflessness without kindness, right? Anyway, so, and then I was kind of thinking about how all of those qualities feed into each other because, you know, courage is only courage when it's intelligently done. Otherwise, it's only recklessness, you know?
Yeah.
So, anyway, I was just kind of thinking about how Janine kept saying, this is for the good of the system, you know, everything will break down if we don't do it this way. But then it seems like a very imbalanced system run by really imbalanced people that actually, instead of getting rid of man's depravity, accentuates it because they're not learning and growing in a bunch of different fields. They're only thinking about one quality. So, anyway.
Well, yeah, and when you talk about the overlap of them, one of the articles we read that'll be in the show notes is from a guest of the show, J.R. Foresteros. He's talking about how Triss goes into Dauntless, and she learns things in Dauntless that help her understand abnegation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he says that self-sacrifice for the good of the other is where selflessness and bravery meet. It's much braver to offer up your own life to rescue the other than it is to meet their violence with violence of your own. You know, so if she was just in Dauntless, then she would have fought when she was confronted.
Mm-hmm.
But she obviously was divergent because she can think outside the box. And she's like, hey, I don't have to meet my problems like a Dauntless would, mm-hmm. by being resourceful and probably taking action. It's like you can incorporate these other things. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in her tests that she kept taking. And that's what we saw displayed by her mom later in the movie when her mom basically sacrificed herself. Mm-hmm. And her dad. Her dad specifically intentionally sacrificing himself to make sure that she was okay. And to continue what Laura's already said, kind of, you know, selflessness or sacrifice in these cases, I mean, you do need a little bit of every one of the factions that they've done. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think I heard you mention Kandor. I keep wanting to say it like Endor. Kandor. Because, I mean, like, at some point you have to judge where justice is.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I still don't know why they did a lot of the things they did in this movie, like where their moral compass come from, like what is right and wrong,
mm-hmm.
what really makes, if Janine Matthews really believes that human nature is the enemy, you know, human nature to keep secrets, to lie, to steal, to be destructive, is the problem with society, then, you know, why are we stopping her? Because she really is just trying to make society better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
well, I don't know. Do you like have Divergent, what happened in the book, really fresh in your mind?
It's probably been like 6 or 7 months since I've read it. So
she's erudite; it doesn't leave.
That's one of the reasons why I went back through the book today, because so when I was watching the movie, the premise did seem a little bit. Not silly, but like it did have a lot of logic holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
And like if you put it under any kind of scrutiny, things started to crumble a little bit. But I never remember thinking about it when I read the book. I never thought, oh, this is kind of dumb. Or I never started asking questions like, well, why don't they do this? Or, you know.
Where's the sorting hat? I don't see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember reading the book and not really asking a lot of questions. But then when I watched the movie, and this was the part of the movie that I thought was kind of corny, but it's when they start describing the factions and Dauntless comes out, and just the way they're acting just seems so far-fetched. Mm-hmm. Like, really? I don't really see them that way. I see them as being, you know, more brave and definitely taking risk, but they were just kind of, you know, I don't even know how to describe
loud
it.
Loud and obnoxious.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Very much loud and obnoxious. But I don't remember thinking that in the movie or thinking that it was far-fetched.
Mm-hmm.
But I did think it was a little far-fetched, especially with the Dauntless when they were describing them in the movie.
Yeah, because to me, they in the movie, especially before you really got into Dauntless to start the 90-minute montage of her training.
Yeah.
They basically came off as like a whole faction of loud frat guys.
Yes.
You know?
Very much so.
You know, like, oh, dude,
but
do
goth.
It.
Yeah. Or, I don't know.
Yeah.
Black is very slimming, you see.
But, and also, I didn't read the whole book over again, but I was specifically looking for places where Janine in the book was expressing this same concern as she did in the movie about, like, just wanting the world to be better. In the book, to me, she's just a villain. I mean, she's someone who wants power. She's not necessarily doing it for the good of the country. I mean, she might be saying those things to her faction so that they'll be on board and help her develop the serum and all this kind of stuff. But she's really doing it because she has the hatred for abnegation and she wants all the power.
Yeah, and that's the sense that I got from the book. I do not recall, and you know, I could be missing or not remembering correctly, but I do not recall her talking about human nature and how it was, like, corrupt. I don't remember any of that. I just remember thinking of her, like you said, as the villain and her wanting to have power instead of abnegation.
Well, and to get all meta again, this is why I really feel like Jesus would be Divergent. Because I think he would call us, or I think much like almost anything we can do in life, you would think they could be good, like even a really positive thing like bravery, or like being a scholar, being really intelligent. That seems like a really great thing, you know, being being a real student of the law or being helpful. But without like a frame to put that in, or without context, then it can easily corrupt. And because, like, I see her faction of, like, highly intelligent people being like, we're really smart, and we think the really smart people should be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing from, you know, Candor that's there being like, look, you know, this is something you have to take in consideration. You know, justice is something you have to understand. So they don't have this concept of, you know, really right and wrong. It's just the end goal. You know, I don't think Christ would ever call us to be smarter than someone just to be smarter than them. He would be like, be smart so you can engage people. You know, be selfless so you can serve people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, have purpose behind these traits. And I feel like I talked about that for like 15 minutes or and now I'm back on it. But, like, you know, that's what I'm saying. Like, I feel like he frames this, and if we're called to be like him, then we would be Divergent too, because, you know, like, even if I'm not the smartest person, like, I'm still supposed to be smart. It was like, you know, it's like the body conversation earlier. Just because I'm an arm and not an eye doesn't mean I never need to try. You know, we're still all going, we still have the same purpose, the same end goal. And that's the frame that I really wish this movie had, or I didn't feel like it had, at least that I saw in the first movie.
I think that's part of, you know, in the second book, where some of the things in the society start to break down a little bit, because in the first book, and I'm not giving away any spoilers, but in the first book, each faction kind of thinks that their faction is the best.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really see a lot of, yeah, they interact in the streets maybe a little bit, but they're really separate and they don't give feedback from, you know, they don't have conversations, and learn from one another. It's all very separate. And so I think that just starts to break down as the series continues.
So it proves that point, is that it's not sustainable.
Yeah.
This Christianity Today article said this about that concept. Of course, caring for others is at the heart of Christianity, but so is standing up for the truth, being wise, exercising courage, and fostering peace. There's something to Four's idea that he'd like to be all of those things, and something dangerous and even sinister when, in our zeal to help people discover their unique, quote-unquote, gifts and talents and personalities, we ignore the fact that it's just those things we're not naturally good at that we ought to work at. Which I think is part of, like, the body thing, that we help each other. Like, we're part of a whole. We're not autonomous. We need one another. Yeah. It's like the overarching sentiment. I wrote down, how can we grow or help each other grow if we're letting one or more of our qualities atrophy? Actually, what you're saying about, like, about Jesus being the third way or Divergent or whatever, just the way that you phrase that actually sounds a lot to me like how Veronica Roth maybe is seeing things, and that's why she had a lot of the Divergence come out of abnegation, because maybe at the heart of your intelligence or your courage or whatever, maybe selflessness has to be a base there, or else you're going to be doing those things for yourself and not for...
Well, they're the only ones that are looking to other people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they're the ones caring for the factionless.
Right.
And technically they're running the government, which is rationing food. I mean, they didn't really list a lot of the things the government did, mm-hmm. but it was basically like rationing food and running, quote marks, running the government, whatever that means.
Right.
You know, apparently if not efficiently enough for some people.
Well, I think one of the big, and you can tell me if I'm wrong about this because I don't remember 100%, but I think one of the big sticking points, which was the reason why people were angry with abnegation, is that they were giving rations to the factionless. They were caring for the factionless and making that a big priority. And that was something that people kept bringing up, that you say you're feeding the factionless, but you're really just keeping the food for yourself.
Yeah.
You know, that was an area where they were starting to bad rumors or whatever about them.
I know it would get us, well, I don't want to say totally off topic, but the thing that I definitely pulled from this was just the almost political correlations that you could have with it. Because I think between the two that are really fighting for control of New Chicago, does it have a name in the book?
Just Chicago.
It does.
Right.
Yeah,
fenced in Chicago.
Yeah.
New Chicago.
While they're fighting for control, the only two real factions that are trying to be in control of it are the ones that are very, very selfless, which, once again, is almost a characterization of that, and the people who are really smart and want things to be super efficient and kind of like, well, they're out, so why are we wasting resources on them? And to me, over-characterization, because I don't want to demonize either side, but kind of point out how both don't have it, is, you know, like, the abnegation strikes me as, like, they're the ones that are pushing for welfare and social yeah. programs in government, and, you know, erudite's one being like, we need more efficient, we need less waste, we need to stop all the spending on things that, you know, you just need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps because we're smart and we know how. So, you know, why do we care about these people who yeah. can't make the cut? And like I said, that is a little bit of a, obviously a over-characterization, kind of possibly unfair to one of our political parties. But I think that's why, again, the real answer is that neither of these should probably be fully in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Because selflessness needs like a container
yeah.
of, you know, well, like we've already said, all these other factions. You know, you need to know why you're doing something, how to do it effectively. And that's why we're never going to really agree because, you know, half the people we send to our government are, you know, get it done. And half the people are, well, you know, it's okay. We got a little bit extra money. Let's spend it on these other things. And when there's waste, you know, the people who are erudite have a really good claim to being right. And when there's people that aren't being cared for, the people who are abnegation have a really good claim to that things aren't right. And so without both of those collaborating, we just need a divergent government, you know?
Very true.
So,
I think it's easier to see erudite's villainy than abnegation, especially in the movie, you know, when they're all being herded by Dauntless, like yeah. about to be. They just seem like this helpless group of people that how could they be in the wrong at all? But I think that's why it's good to have Marcus as kind of a, not necessarily a representative of abnegation, but a picture of what someone from abnegation yeah. could be like that's against, you know.
He's not perfect.
Yeah, that's against yeah. the stereotype because he's selfless, but if he was being selfless for the right reasons, then, and not just to like conform to a group or, you know, because he wanted to be seen a certain way, then I feel like he wouldn't be abusing his son. And when he abuses Tobias, he is often saying, this is for your own good. This is yeah. to help you, to teach you, whatever.
Because I'm so selfless.
But that, anyway, I just wanted to mention him because I think it's easy to see abnegation as just the good guys. But you're right. I think like we've been saying, there needs to be a balance of all these qualities to really make something work.
Mm-hmm. Well, which is one of the first questions that I thought. I was like, oh, I'll ask just to get a conversation started. You know, who do you think Jesus would want in charge. What did I put? I said, WWJPIC. Who would Jesus put in charge? You know, which faction? And hopefully come into the conclusion that, you know, none of them. I mean, like, not just one, or, well, he's Jesus. So he probably would put all of them in charge separately, to work together, like he has in real life. But I mean, like, could you really make a case for any particular faction as the best person to be in charge?
I don't think so.
No, I think we've kind of disproved that that's possible.
I don't know. As a representative of candor, I think I think the judges would be the most just and can do the best job. So I just want to say that.
You know, I think this world, this new Chicago, maybe they're trying to do that by having, you know, different people in charge of different things, you know, saying like, you're good at that. You do that for the good of everybody. So is it just breaking down because not all of them are part of making governmental decisions? Is that why their model is not working? Or, I mean, because I think maybe that's a picture of them trying to be the body, you know, you're like, oh, you're a good hand, be a hand. You know, we need hands to farm, you know? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that's why, like I said, I don't necessarily mind. I see society doing this already. That people are factioning up. You know, when you go into, like, a company or something, lots of times they'll pay. Like, I just interviewed for, well, I didn't just interview, but a couple months ago I interviewed for the job that I have now. And one of the things that I had to do was I had to take, there's so many names for them now, but it was one of the many, many, like, personality skills kind of tests. And so, you know, they got back like, he's an extroverted person who is, you know, self-sustaining or whatever, and that, you know, whatever, you know, so they wanted to know, so they know how to do I fit with their group?
Yeah,
you know. Now, is that all there is to me? No. But I mean, like I said, I think there's good in that. There's, like I said, it's good to know that you're an arm if you're an arm, and if you're an eye if you're an eye. And we keep saying this all podcast long. You know, I mean, that's why I think that, like, the Myers-Briggs, you know, the spiritual gifts assessments, they can be really helpful. But like Laura, you pointed out earlier, I think if we put all of our, you know, all of our skill points into just one thing, we're really letting our other things atrophy, and that's not really helping anyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just being partial people at that point. We're not being the whole person because, you know, well, I mean, in Tristan Forrest's case, they have all of these qualities within them, and I'm sure, I mean, I could argue that everybody has those qualities within them. I mean, and maybe that's the point, is that Tristan for are not the only divergence, you know, that her mom clearly showed various qualities. So
I assume her mom was divergent.
I think she is.
Based on,
I feel like she is. I don't know which book I figured that out from, but I'm pretty sure
she's
is.
She's not, like, revealed to be divergent in the first book, but so anyway, we're just, I mean, I guess it could be true that if you give people the freedom to be their whole self, because it's a fallen world, there are qualities in us that are not good, you know, not for our good or the good of other people. And so, you know, there is a risk at saying, like, be your whole self instead of trying to suppress, you know, everything but the thing you're best at. But I think there's more good to be gained from allowing people to be their whole, wholly who they are, than it. I think the good outweighs the risk.
And I feel like the only way that society with factions could have worked would be to have a government that is run by, you know, people from each faction,
right,
from where they, so where that there's like a council and they are, you know, discussing things and hearing from one another and interacting more. Or maybe even having divergent people lead the government. But when there's no interaction and there's no, like, learning from one another, then, you know, it doesn't work.
Hmm. Well, the only other thing that I really wanted to kind of touch on, we can do it really briefly before we start wrapping up, is, like, I guess I never really understood why divergents were that big of a deal. Or why they were so dangerous.
Well, I think it's because they can subvert the system. And they can't be controlled.
Okay.
Because there are simulations that they go through, specifically in Dauntless, they use them to, like, to train you to overcome your fear. Mm-hmm. And I think they might be used in other... They were used to see what faction you belong to. But the thing that is much better explained in the book, obviously, is that Triss and Four are able to overcome the system. They're able to, like, trick their minds into saying, this isn't real, this isn't me or whatever. Which is why even when Four is given, like, the heavy-duty serum at the end, Triss is able to get into his mind, and he has the power, because he's divergent, to, like, overcome
recognize
that.
It. It's not
right.
real. Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe, I think maybe in this world, that's the thing. They can, they're dangerous because they can't be controlled, because they're not contained to one thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because they're different.
I guess I wanted it to be more complex than that.
Sorry, man.
No. Well, I mean, like you said, in the movie, Janine kept saying so many things about human nature and human nature being the problem. And I felt like they could have done a lot more with that. But ultimately, if it really is only because it doesn't fit the system, I feel like that's another kind of intellectual pseudo plot hole.
Well, it's what I was just saying, that, like, there's a risk to allowing someone to be everything, to being the things you're not great at, because you're going to bumble through it and mess it up, and being the things that you are good at. And so, I mean, in that way, somebody who's divergent would be dangerous, because they, just because they are all these things, can't have access to all these qualities, doesn't mean they're awesome in all these qualities. I mean, Triss is kind of presented as a person who is the best at everything. But for even his tattoo in the book, some of the symbols for the factions are larger than others, because he identifies more with those than he does some of them. And he even says, I'm still working on kindness. I'm not great at being kind. So maybe that's the thing that makes them feel so dangerous, is that they have access to this, like, wholeness of living that is dangerous, because they could bring in some of those corrupt qualities or whatever. And so they need to be controlled. I don't know.
Okay. Divergence bad.
Yes, divergence are bad.
Well, unless there's anything else you guys want to specifically bring up. Pause.
I did say I can't really blame Veronica Roth too much about the whole world building thing, because... And like I said, when I was reading the book, I didn't think about, oh, that doesn't make sense. That's illogical, whatever. The stakes felt high to me, and I cared about Triss, and I cared about Four, and I liked their relationship, and I liked all the other characters, the friendships that were built, and I just feel like, I feel like her book was about Triss. It wasn't about, maybe in the way that The Hunger Games is sort of about a society that needs to be destroyed. I felt like this book was not about that so much as it's just a framework for Triss and who she is and what she's struggling with. So I can't really blame her too much for that, because I feel like if she had cared so much about just making sure the world was airtight, I think maybe the characters would have suffered. And I don't know, you told me, Mikey, when I was writing my book, just tell the story.
Just tell the story.
And so that's what I did. I just told the story of my characters that I cared a lot about. And I felt like I felt what they were going through, and I wanted to show that to other people. And I mean, maybe I have a lot of grace for Roth, because I feel like my society isn't like, you know, I didn't do like a ton of research. I don't have like names for all the people in charge. I don't have a big history written about what happened to the world. It's just a framework for my characters. Yeah. So any big holes that you felt from the movie were because of things they did in the movie, and not because of the book, not because of the original story.
Yeah. And you know, I said this earlier, but I thought, that the book did a really good job of focusing on their relationship, on Triss and her relationships, and they don't really focus on that as much in the movie, but because they focus on relationships, you're kind of like following the characters and not really noticing that maybe the world isn't created wonderfully. And then, you know, so in the movie, when you look at it and you're just seeing, you know, you're seeing a lot of the world and how it's created, it's like, oh, that's kind of not how I pictured it, because I wasn't paying attention to that when I was reading the book. Mm-hmm. I was paying attention to the characters.
Plus, like, you know, we're able, I think in the book, we are in Triss's head. And so we're at that level. But in the movie, we're at a more macro level in which we're seeing everything that's happening, I think more so than the book. And from that perspective, I think as almost an omniscient perspective, we're saying, oh, well, this puzzle piece doesn't fit here. But I think as like a member of the society, especially a teenager, she's not going to have a great handle on what's everything that's happening in the world and why it's happening and the history of everything. I think the book does a better job of presenting a more realistic perspective, which is the perspective we have of our own society. There are problems that we see in our own government, but we don't get the big picture. We don't get to look at the whole thing.
Yeah.
Maybe you do.
I get the big picture.
Anyway, so, yeah.
Well, I mean, what you're saying basically strikes as the reason that even though the market is probably flooded with young adult literature, this one has kind of risen above because focusing on the relationships, the development of that character, the struggle with identity and who you are and how you fit in basically is going to be almost every middle and high school student in the entire world.
Yeah.
So, well.
And post-college, obviously. And
yeah. Apparently right in college. Yeah.
Because I read it.
Oh, if only we could have gone back and chose a different faction when we got out of college.
It wouldn't have worked, Mikey. Wouldn't have worked.
Well, it's so weird because there's so many things that I wish I like would have got like now, like 10 years removed from college. Or, yeah, almost 10 years removed from college because I'm old. I would have like, man, I should have gone to this other college because there's things that I didn't know that I enjoyed doing until now. Like podcasting. I should have gone to a school for like sound design and engineering and broadcasting. But if I would have done that, then I wouldn't have ended up in the school faction that my wife was in. And I'm like, well, I guess it was worth it.
Wow.
So, the school faction.
Thanks for that. I guess I'll take what I can get.
Rather be poor and happy than rich with somebody who doesn't really love me.
And that's why I'd rather just be erudite and always learning and go to school all the time. Because then whatever new things I want to learn, I can just go and learn those.
Right there.
That's right. Well, with that said, I guess we'll wrap up like you usually do and move from the themes to just things. Things right now that we call our come on moments. The things that kind of annoyed us. Maybe a character, maybe a scene, interaction, a bad line, just a plot hole that really you just couldn't shake in the film. So, Laura, Arian,
who wants to? I've already said mine. It's when they introduce the Dauntless and they're just very stereotypical. And, you know, once you get in the compound and you meet four, you know, that some of that breaks down. But, I just was like, really? They're running around and giving one another a high five. And yeah, that was just really, really hard for me to suspend belief and kind of see that. But.
I would have to say that if it's so dangerous to be divergent in the society.
Dang it.
I know you take yours. If it's so dangerous to be divergent in the society, I probably wouldn't get a huge effing tattoo on my back of all the factions.
That's true. I didn't think about that. I was like, does anyone else see that ever?
I'm the only hunky guy that never takes off his shirt.
Well, actually, he does say in the book that he doesn't often shows tattoos with people, but anyway, I just kind of imagine like someone being like, oh, Tobias, you're divergent. Oh yeah, of course you are.
You know, you're like, a tattoo.
Duh, I'm a dummy.
He showers alone. He's a never nude.
No wonder. Anyway,
yeah, that was the thing. I was like, he just gives this line that says like, I don't want to be just one thing. I can't be. I want to be brave. I want to be selfless, intelligent, and honest and kind. Well, I'm still working on kind. And I'm like, dude, you have a big tattoo It's like a, it should, might as well just be like a target.
I am divergent.
Yeah. I just
stop looking. So
that was probably the thing that made me roll my eyes. Like, did no one think of this? Other than that, the only thing that really kind of got me besides that, that, you know, I haven't kind of mentioned as a mild, the Sorting Hat a little bit, but, was Ansel Elgort, who is Triss's brother, who's going to be in.
Oh, okay.
Who is going to be, you know, in a fault with her, I don't know the name of the movie.
Her brother in Divergent, who is going to be her love interest in The Fault in Our Stars, which
Thank
is
you,
weird.
Arian. So I just thought he was awful. Like, yeah. Every time he was on screen, I was like, stop ruining this movie. And so it makes me a little scared for the other movie that I'm hoping will be good.
Yeah, I didn't really pay a lot of attention to him in the movie. I think I was really focusing on Triss and Four because I really didn't know how their characters were going to play out, especially Shailene. She looked too big for the part of Triss. Like, you know, her as tall as she is. And
you said she's a little chunky. She probably needs to go on a diet.
No, they just painted her as a very like kind of small, fragile person in the book.
I have heard that a lot too.
And but I think the other characters that she was up against were bigger than her, so it made it work.
Yeah. Well, then we transition from that to what was just the best part of the movie for any of the same reasons, you know, characters, moments. Just what was the part that you came away and you can't get out your mind.
Mine is the same in the movie as it was in the book. And it's kind of very sappy and romantic. But it's the part when Four is under the more intense simulation, or what is it called? Serum. And Triss is able to pull him out of that by her willingness to sacrifice herself for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely, you know, by the time that scene rolled around, I had been able to become invested in them. And so that was probably one of the moments that I felt the most deeply, I guess. And I thought it was really well adapted to the screen, that scene. And especially with them prefacing the fact that he had to, like, look away when he shot the innocent in his fear simulation or whatever, which is not in the book. He didn't look away when he shot her, but yeah, I think that whole thing was well played. But I also really did like the zip line. I liked it when she was flying across the city, and it was just kind of a picture of, like, she'd come into her own, that she felt like she'd made a good choice, that she felt like she belonged. And anyway, I like the zipline part.
I also like the chemistry between the two of them. Laura knows that I have a very, very big pet peeve when people take the easy way out in cinematic relationships. And it's like, oh, we need to show that these people were really into each other. Okay, let's just make them have sex. So now you know that they're into each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Literally, they're into each other.
Thank you.
Because I think it's lazy, and I don't think that that's always. I think there's other ways to show it, and it's harder to show that two people are really connecting without basically them meeting and then going directly home and having sex.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they found a way to convince me that they were kind of falling for one another without basically skipping straight to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was impressive. Not my favorite part, but because I was just pleasantly surprised by that. I think probably my favorite line was one that I think I actually maybe laughed out loud a little bit, which rarely happens. I'm usually just like a big smiler. I usually actually audibly laugh at a lot of things. They were breaking back into Dauntless headquarters, and Peter said, you wouldn't shoot me. And she says, why does everyone keep saying that? And then she shoots him. I just thought it was, great because, I mean, people say that all the time to people and they never, they actually never do basically shoot people. And then she did.
Yeah.
And so, and then my number two would be, Jai Courtney, who played Eric. The guy from Dauntless with the earrings.
No,
the,
I didn't like him.
Well, I didn't like him as a character.
Yeah.
But I thought he would. I was like, I'm with him. That guy's a jerk.
He's playing his part really
and he's
well.
He's playing a really good jerk. I just like, you know, all his glances, and you could tell that he was jealous of Ford just from some of the looks he gave. I was pretty impressed by his performance. Don't like his character, obviously. He's kind of a jerk. But I was sitting there being like, I like when this guy's on screen. He's kind of, he's selling me on this. And he had very, you know, very just little snippets of screen time to do that with, too. So I enjoyed that. But so, unless there's anything else y'all want to add, that more or less wraps us up.
I think so.
I think Divergent really taught us that sexy people do not take off their shirts the way other people do.
That's right.
You never see a sexy person like struggling one arm out of the other. They just like grab the hem. And
no, they don't.
Oh, that's right. They grab it
from the back.
All hunky guys in movies take off their shirt the same way. Well, unless they're getting ready to do it. And then sometimes they do it like this. But no way that any human being actually takes off clothing.
Do they do? Who invented that?
Because there's the... Well, I'm obviously not going to do it because I don't want you to stumble here. But, you know,
grab
like...
Grab it from the neck.
They grab it from, like, the back of the neck. And so it flexes every single muscle on the way out. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. And so from now on, I'm always going to take off my shirt like that when I'm at home. And I'm like, hey, Laura, do you want to see my tattoos? You know, and she's like, no, I really don't. We're done. And I'm like, but look at everything flex. Oh, so crazy. Movies.
Oh, man.
But I bet he didn't take his shirt off that way in the book.
No, I don't remember.
He probably was like, took his shirt off.
I just read that scene, and he grabbed the hem and pulled it over his
head. He was like.
He was like, and he said in the book, he said, oh, I don't really show my tattoos to a lot of people. And she goes, why wouldn't you? Look at you.
Oh, gosh. I don't remember that.
Yeah.
It's getting a little hot in here.
There was a lot of sexual tension between them in the book.
Oh.
Lots of lingering touches. Well,
yes.
Well. Anything else? That you'd like to tangentialize us with?
I'm very excited about seeing the next movie and just kind of, you know, seeing how they adapt that to the screen. And I really enjoyed the second book, so I'm curious to see if they do a good adaptation.
I was kind of curious where you go after like how they ended the movie. He's like, hey, we're on a train. Hope this train doesn't ever go back to the only city that's in this story. Oh, wait. I don't understand what's going on. Okay, I'll think about it next movie. But I am more excited about watching the second, I guess, Insurgent than I am, that I was going to see the second Hunger Games movie or, you know, second Harry Potter movie or, you know, whatever you want to compare the movies to. So,
have you seen all the Harry Potter movies?
I have because you made me watch them all.
Okay,
I'm very impressed.
Now, I mean, I enjoyed some of them.
Have you read any of the books? Ted, they're so good. Just start with number four. And then go back and read one through three. You've already seen the movies, so it'll be fine.
That's the problem. I've already seen the movies. This is one of my fatal...
Yeah, there's no reason to read the books when you've seen the movies.
It's really hard for me to read a book after I've already seen the movie. That's actually with Game of Thrones right now. Like, I saw the first series... I saw season one of Game of Thrones before I read the first Game of Thrones book. And it was really hard to get through the first Game of Thrones book because I wasn't just free to be like, I'm taking in the story.
Yeah.
I was basically going...
You want to know what happened next.
I was like, this is different, something new, come on. You know, and so I was basically critiquing the book at that point. Whereas once season one ended, I read the first book. And then before season two came out, I read the second book in the Game of Thrones series. which was very daunting. You know, it's like 900 pages too.
Yeah.
But then when I was watching the series, and I was able to just kind of enjoy the series, being like, oh, I remember that from the book, or that's great. But reading is such a task for me. It has to be new and kind of whatever.
I like that every time you mention you've read the Game of Thrones books, you have to say how long they are.
Well, it's because, like,
people want to know that you're not just reading some
deal.
Little thing.
It is. Well, it's a big deal.
I mean, it's kind of a big deal. I mean, especially since I read so few things. Like, how many other things I could read?
It's really pretty much maybe four other size books.
It's like four other books. I didn't even say that part. So, but I mean, I'll totally take it. It's like four other books.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
So you can handle Harry Potter easily.
Yeah, I could, but I've seen the movies.
Going back to point.
Well, no, I mean, even things that I really, really love. Like, I would love to read the book that the Band of Brothers series is based on. But I'm like, I've seen Band of Brothers now. And I just. And I love military history and things like that, and I still just I don't know. Anyway, that's my personal problem. I would really highly recommend people take your advice and do that very thing, to read the books if they haven't.
But it's not for you.
I don't do that very often, where I see the movie before I read the book. The only one that I can think of recently is Silver Linings Playbook. I saw the movie and loved it, and I really loved the book too. But I can see, you know, especially with like Harry Potter, like you see the movie and you know what's happening, and then you're like, oh, well, that's not as exciting as it was before, because I, you know all of the things.
Yeah. I know all the things.
But
I'd go back and read comics after I saw a comic book movie.
Yeah. That doesn't count.
Yeah.
What? Comics count.
They do. I tell my students all the time, comics count. So, I don't enjoy them very much, but they do count as reading.
Okay. Well, thank you guys for being here. Especially you, Laura. I know he had to come a long way from upstairs.
I had to put on socks for this.
Socks. So, because I am so grateful, and because you were kind enough to be here and join us for this conversation, I always want to give you a chance to kind of let people know how to get a hold of you. So, whichever one wants, Arian, you get to go first.
Sure. I am on Twitter. Arian Jones is my handle, and I have not tweeted in a long time. So,
but if you tweet at her,
I will reply.
She's just waiting for the right tweet.
I just stalk people. That's all.
I understand.
But I'm also have a blog where I do book reviews with a friend of mine, and it's fictionfinders.blogspot.com that I do a much better job of updating.
What are you reading lately?
I am reading, currently I'm reading, The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey, which is really good. It's about a man whose wife has died, and they owned a bookstore together, and it's like his life after she passes away, and it kind of goes back to a lot of different stories and talks about a lot of different stories that have influenced him as he grieves. And, you know, it's a very good book.
You're doing this all wrong. You're supposed to be like, it's an amazing book, and I know if you would love to learn about it, you should go to my site.
Yeah, you should.
Well, but you are writing a review of it when you're done.
Yeah, I'll write a review. Definitely.
I try to blog once a week on my Leaving Teaching WordPress blog, and I try really hard to write Doctor Who posts for Real World, but I don't do a great job of that. Anyway, but I also am on Twitter, and everything's connected to my Twitter account. My handle is Laura_Fizzle, I think.
Well, and since we're not sure about some of these things, I'll make sure to have the actual links in the show notes so you'll be able to find them. If you want to interact with me or let me know of movies you'd love to hear us discuss on the show, then feel free to follow me on the Real World Theology Twitter at Real World Theo, or follow me personally for, you know, some movie stuff, some just random things at Fizzification. You can also find us at our blog, realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. But then again, if you're listening to this, you probably already know it's the R-E-E-L. So I'm just talking to myself now. Like us on Facebook. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Also, now, for Android users, you can find us on Stitcher. For the people who are getting on the Stitcher bandwagon, I believe it's stitcher.com/podcast /real-world-theology. So also will be in the show notes, so you don't have to write that down, especially if you're driving. Don't write that down if you're driving. But anyway, if you find us on either of those mediums, leave us a review. It'll help more people find the show, get more people involved in the conversation. I do want to give a shout out to Kitten Mysteries, who just reviewed the show on iTunes. I appreciate that review.
Thanks, Kitten.
So keep listening. I'm sorry I don't put the show quite often enough. If anyone would like to donate money to the show so I can go see more movies, I will gladly do the show more often. But right now it's pretty hefty to see a movie these days, even matinees. But anyway, I just want to thank my guests for being here. You, the listeners, for taking the time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, continue to remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.